Well, Finance Minister Tito Mboweni, presenting his medium-term budget policy statement yesterday, reminded us that the country's aloe ferox is drought-resistant. But the aloe is also bitter, and the bitter pill that the country needs to swallow was partially delivered yesterday with spending cuts announced in 2023-24. For every 1 rand of tax revenue, though, government plans to spend 1 rand 29. That's the bottom line. Since 94, the average has been 1 rand 16 and 1 rand 18. In the 10 years since, we continue to spend money that we just don't have. This mini budget was far from good enough to avoid a debt trap, and combined with a reconstruction and recovery plan that also fell short of what is needed in South Africa at this point, the risks have certainly increased significantly. And now, while Treasury has encouragingly strengthened the proposed wage bill cuts, the budget raises serious concerns about whether South Africa will be able to avoid a fiscal cliff. This year, for example, 57% of our taxes will go to fund public sector workers who have been largely kicking back at home, contemplating their state retirement packages during the COVID crisis. And the risks we are facing as an economy are highlighted in the abandonment of the active scenario that was presented in June as the only way to avoid a debt trap. What we see now is that debt ratio expected to peak even higher at 95%, and with clear upside risks. The fiscal cliff is getting ever closer. Let's welcome our panel, economist Raymond Parsons of the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, Martin Kingston, Chair of the Steering Committee of Business for South Africa, and Matthew Parks, Parliamentary Coordinator for COSATU. At the heart of this whole process, Raymond, perhaps you can kick us off, was a need to make substantial cuts to expenditure to stabilize debt and to prevent issuance levels and debt service costs getting out of hand and avoiding that fiscal cliff edge. Treasury appears to have been able to push through some quite deep cuts versus the budget in February, but over time, these rely more and more on compensation. The real question is, could the Treasury have done more given the circumstances and given the politics?
Well, I think, Michael, that the ministers had a rather bad press overnight. So let me say something positive to start with. And that is, he was very honest and frank about the economic and the indeed fiscal scenarios that he has to deal with. But that said, I think what matters, of course, is not the diagnosis with which we're all familiar, but the solutions. And I think just to understand the magnitude of what we're facing, there are three traps here that have to be bridged. There's the growth trap, there's the debt trap, and above all now, there is the credibility trap. And I think if we look at those three, we can then decide what reaction there's going to be to what was in the so-called mini budget and what some of the consequences might be. When we come to the issue of government spending, of course we want fiscal consolidation, but it makes quite a lot of difference where you cut and why you cut and how you prioritize. And that's quite important. And I think the balance in the budget yesterday seemed to me still to be too much on the negative side and not enough on the growth side. And I think once again, if we stand back and we look at the bigger picture of this whole fiscal scenario, the problem here is that all roads eventually lead through the growth rate, whichever way you cut it, whichever way you look at it. So firstly, by having postponed the debt ceiling by having raised it and having postponed it by another 2 years, you may argue, well, that's being quite realistic given the constraints. The problem is, and I come back to the credibility issue, if this was a once-off, if this was purely the fault of the COVID-19, then you would say, well, of course, we'll all cut some slack, including the rating agencies. But the fact is, we've been here so many more times before. And the bottom line then comes, we've got to get this economy turned around. We've got to get growth, job-rich growth going, so that you can, in a credible way, say, we can grow out of this problem. But that means that beyond what was said yesterday, lies structural reform, the growth plan, and that big I word, implementation. And I think that's around which the whole credibility gap now revolves, not only in terms of what was promised in the mini budget yesterday, but also in terms of the issues that lie outside the budget. And I want to end by simply saying that once again, although we are addressing what the minister said yesterday and what he would like to do, the fact remains it's a collective responsibility, and the outcomes will depend as much upon his colleagues as it depends upon what the National Treasury can do.
I think on that last point, Martin, to bring you in there, that's perhaps where markets felt a little bit disappointed yesterday, in that all of these cuts are proposed. The deal with Labour is still up in the air, for example, and many other issues seem to still be a part of a process of consultation. And so there does still present a lot of downside risk to an implementation risk to the plan that's been presented.
Well, there is considerable implementation risk, and the markets would be right to be sceptical. Indeed, as we've already discussed, as Raymond has said, these commitments have been made before, but have not been delivered against. I think that actually public trust is now wafer thin. The markets are sceptical, and the focus is going to have to be on delivering a fundamental structural reform. That is the only way that we're going to get private sector-led growth. I think that both the Minister of Finance and the President have made it clear that the private sector is the key to unlocking that growth path. We're working very closely with our social partners at NEDLAC, including Matthew from COSATU, and we've agreed on almost all the elements of the reconstruction and recovery plan. But agreeing on a plan without having the wherewithal to implement it actually is where the problem lies. We now need to be able to demonstrate that the proof of the pudding is actually in the eating. There are some very fundamental commitments that have been made, including, as you say, dealing with the public sector wage bill, that we must all live within our means. We have very limited means. The minister made it absolutely clear that we are approaching a debt crisis. We hope that it's only, by the way, 3 years or 4 years away rather than just around the corner, but we can see that yields are going up, our ability to access capital is going to reduce, and therefore those quick wins that we've been talking about for not months, Michael, but years now needs to be delivered. Whether it is spectrum, whether it is dealing with the energy sector, whether it is the restructuring of ESCOM within that context, dealing with specialist skill visas. These have been talked about for an extended period of time. Nobody is going to wait anymore. We now need to deliver very specifically. And on that point, I want to echo again what the Minister of Finance said, which is no one of the social partners, including government, can deliver this output on their own. If we don't manage to harness all of the resources, skills, capabilities, and experience required, we will not deliver against these commitments.
On that point of all of the social partners sharing the pain, Matthew, and on the wage bill, this is the first time in the democratic era that we see government proposing a three-year wage freeze for public servants. The issue for me, though, was when the minister said that the Minister of Public Service and Administration, Senzo Mchunu, was speaking with Labour at the moment, was meeting with unions to discuss how best the parties adapt to this reality. That's certainly not what you told me on Tuesday. Is the minister lying?
I think the minister might have been massaging facts a little bit. When I talked to my colleagues on Tuesday evening about the latest situation, there hadn't been any formal meetings. There was proposals for some meetings or for some discussions. So that's not an engagement. But I think the fact is, Michael, we're 7 months into the financial year. There's been no formal engagement by government. In fact, government has at times refused to engage, saying there's a court process, there's no need to engage. And even the proposal of a three-year wage freeze or significant wage restraint wasn't tabled at the PSCBC. It was something we saw in the media. So I think from our side, we recognize government is in a serious crisis, just like workers and the economy is in a serious crisis for a long time. We are in this boat together. We must find a way that addresses all of our critical challenges so that we can all survive. But government has to engage. Look, our problems are not just about the wage bill. The real cause of the fiscal crisis is, as Raymond was saying, we have a stagnant economy. Companies are collapsing. If companies collapse, they cannot pay company tax. If workers are retrenched, they can't pay income tax or VAT, etc. So for us, the fundamental crisis is saving companies, saving jobs, getting the economy moving, because that way you'll generate tax revenue. Because you've seen how tax revenue has been declining even long before COVID. But also, Michael, we can raise as much tax as we want, but if government doesn't get a handle of how it manages public finances, then we're just moving chairs in the Titanic. We can't continue to bleed 150 billion rand from the fiscus every year, because that is equivalent to 5 years of public service wage bill savings that government wants to effect. So for us, those are the critical things that need to be addressed. But around the wage bill, we're glad that the Minister of Finance said that they want to engage. That is a welcome shift, because they haven't engaged. But we're also glad that the Minister of Finance is finally responding to two of the proposals that we've made as Labour, that the workers need to see politicians and management and the CEOs in the state and the SOEs taking wage cuts. You can't simply want to resolve the situation by paying nurses less. Mm. But also, I think for us, we want to see government moving with speed around corruption. We, you know, business and labor tabled bold proposals around corruption, and government has run away from embracing them. So I think for us, you have to juggle many balls at once. But we do agree with government. We can't afford to enter a sovereign debt crisis, because the people who will suffer will be workers and the country at large. But it's about how you do it, what you do first, and can you do it in a win-win, inclusive, and a less reckless way, Michael?
And coming back to growth, Raymond, this is the first time that government is reining back on its ever-expanding basket of support to the poor and the working class. These are the hard decisions that we so often hear about, where we hear the president talking about hard decisions and tough choices that have to be made at NEDLAC. And a lot of that funding is being redirected now to infrastructure, which is at least a positive sign for growth. But we're also seeing funds being moved and reallocated from police and higher education ministries for SAA, from water and sanitation. I mean, the numbers here are staggering. Police and higher education ministries shifted 1.2 and 1.1 billion respectively to pay for a failing state-owned airline in the middle of a global pandemic, which is supposed to bring in tourists that can't come here because of our borders being shut down.
Well, this comes back to the whole issue of how you reprioritize and do it in the right way. It comes back to the issue of the right balance between consumption spending by government and investment spending. I don't think we've got that balance right. It's full of these distortions. And once again, as you rightly say, if we're aiming for a growth strategy, then how we run the SOEs and what we do about ESCOM and about SAA must underpin that growth strategy. That means you really have to take different decisions. You have to take some tough decisions, and you have to prioritize in a way that gives you the investment level that you need from government, because what the numbers are showing is not just private investment is at a lower level, but in the past few years, of course, that it's government investment that's also let the side down. So it's tremendously important that we get that priority right. But I would also add to that, that once again, in this whole scenario, the worm in the apple of the policy environment is still uncertainty. There's still uncertainty as to where the chips will fall on certain crucial issues. Will we handle the public sector wage bill in the right way? Will the spending limits be enforced? Can we reach the growth forecasts that are essential? Will the structural reforms be implemented? And waiting in the wings, if some other things go wrong, and we really don't have much room to deal with any more shocks, what are we going to do in the main budget? Are we going to put up taxes? That is lying in wait. Which taxes? It's going to make it like spending. You must get the mix right, because very often to do the right thing in the wrong way, sometimes it's fatal. It's just doing the wrong thing. So it's tremendously important that there should be consultation between now and the main budget, that whatever still has to be done will be reflected in a balanced way in that budget. And if I come back to the point that as the Victorian school teacher said to an underperforming student, you must try harder.
Matthew, I want to come back to this issue on the public wage bill, because from what I'm seeing, while demands haven't yet been tabled and consolidated, the spokesperson for the Public Servants Association, Ruben Maleka, and chief negotiator for the public sector unions, Mgwena Maluleke, said that COSATU is going to be asking for increases higher than CPI. Is that true?
Look, I think for us, a couple of things around the public service wage bill. One is that the negotiation must take place in the bargaining council. It can't take place in parliament or NEDLAC or in press statements. You know, always when you go to negotiation, you'll come with an initial position, then you'll find each other at a halfway point, for example. I think for us, the core issue is to protect public servants, especially the lower and middle income earners, from inflation. I think what helps us, Michael, is that inflation has plummeted significantly from the initial budgetary projections in the last couple of years, from 5.5% to about 3.2% and possibly lower than that. So I think that's a core issue for any union, is always to protect members' salaries from inflation. But we've made proposals to government as well about having a single wage agreement for the entire state, because currently the public service wage agreement only covers the 800,000 public servants. It doesn't include the 400,000 who work in entities like SARS or NESFAS or the SOEs like Transnet and Eskom, which are very large employers. And often you find that in those SOEs and the entities, there is no cap on what management earns. So for example, you have at Eskom 800 managers who earned above 2 million rand. You can start putting caps on what management can earn, that can buy space. But for any compromise to be sold to a nurse or a teacher earning 180,000 rand, they would need to see not just a freeze, but cuts from what management, what politicians earn. I think they also would need to see that government is serious about corruption and that government is not just going for low-hanging fruit in the form of PESO, or public service wages, because that's an easy administrative tool, and shirking the responsibility from addressing the real cause of the crisis, which is corruption, wasteful expenditure. But again, Michael, if they come and engage with unions, I think they would find partners who are willing to save the state, because workers have a vested interest in saving the state and saving the economy.
On that issue, what do you make of the decision to pour a further 17 billion rand down the SAA black hole, considering that the money is coming from budgets that would have more nurses or more police or more teachers in classrooms? We're deciding to reallocate that to SAA. What's your position on that?
Look, I think for us, a position for all SOEs is that they have to stand on their own 2 feet. They have to be financially sustainable. The days of bailing them out cannot continue. It's not a sustainable funding model. And as you're saying, it's bleeding the state of badly needed funds. So I think for us, what we're disappointed on is that we have not seen, besides the Eskom Social Compact that we drafted at NEDLAC, we've not seen a clear roadmap for all these SOEs, not just the SAA group, but SABC, Denel, etc. And we cannot continue that they are a burden to the state, they are draining the fiscus. So I think for us, what we really need to see is similar type social compacts and roadmaps for them to get them back on their feet. It's difficult around the aviation industry. Yes, it's a strategic industry, and we're also dealing with 10,000 human beings who have jobs at stake at SCA, 1,500 who have jobs at SA Express. But we need a roadmap, and it's very difficult to know what is the future of the aviation industry. It is critical for tourism. We appreciate it. I think for us, really, what's critical is a clear roadmap to deal with the historical corruption, mismanagement, and repositioning that's needed.
Martin, coming to perhaps some good in the budget, because it was there were a few glimmers of hope. The issue of exchange controls is now very much back on the agenda, and there was talk of making South Africa a gateway, a financial centre, much like Mauritius, into the rest of Africa, and really leveraging off our very well respected financial services sector. What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, inside and outside of NEDLAC, we've had very constructive discussions with the regulators and indeed National Treasury in the financial sector. We found them to be flexible and responsive. They certainly understand the need to ensure that we have a financial system that is a state of the art in terms of being able to ensure that we've got frictionless capital flows and we can attract and retain capital within the country wherever possible. These measures are designed to do that whilst protecting the integrity of the financial services sector and the system more broadly. All of those discussions, I think, have been properly ventilated, and we think that it is the right thing to do. It's an absolutely critical aspect of fundamental structural reform that we have been talking about. I just want to go back to the issue, however, of state-owned enterprises and the point that Raymond was making. I don't believe as a country we have the ability to kick the can down the road to the next budget. I have attended, I cannot remember how many budgets and medium-term budget policy statements over the last few years where we've held our breath only to be disappointed. and to hope that actually 6 months from now, we'll see the fruits of our labor. The problem is that I think that the sands of time have run out on us. The coronavirus pandemic has exacerbated the situation, not just in South Africa, but globally, and we're going to have to take some very difficult decisions. Decisions, I have to say, that we've shied away from. The problem is that the Minister of Finance, who I think was wholly honest and clear in his expose yesterday, is undermined by the very actions that he talks against, such as, for example, continuing to fund SOEs that are perceived to be failing SOEs when we don't have the financial wherewithal so to do. In the final analysis, we are robbing Peter to pay Paul. There's a finite amount of capital. That's exactly what these exchange controls and lifting them are designed to do, is to expand the pool of capital that we can mobilize for South Africa. But we can only do it if we profile ourselves as an appropriately competitive and fit for purpose environment to invest in.
And pouring further money into SAA certainly doesn't send out that particular profile. Raymond, as we end off the conversation, now to turn to the point of credibility, what mix of spending cuts and revenue boosts and rates of change in the debt trajectory would you see as credible now?
Well, let me say at the outset, just to clarify, there are some things that have to be done tomorrow and the day after tomorrow quite quickly. What I meant was that even with the best will in the world, it's possible that our perceptions of 2021 will be influenced by the level of taxation that is decided in February. That could make a difference. I mean, that makes a difference to your whole risk-reward ratio. So in that sense, there's still an elephant out in the room there that we'll have to deal with in 2 or 3 months' time. In the meantime, there needs to be an engagement to get on with several of the things that were in the NEDLAC agreement, which have not yet been implemented, and where we need an implementation summit. If someone has a penchant for more summits, we need an implementation summit, if that will help to concentrate the mind. But the fact is, coming back to the issue of spending, that is why you need to concentrate on that spending or investment by government, which is service orientated. The rest is luxury. And there you've got to cut, and you've got to be very firm about it. There will be social safety nets that must be kept in place. That's important, of course. But I'm just saying that final financial framework will only be consolidated when you see the tax side. All we've seen now is the debt and the spending side. We haven't seen the tax side. That's going to be quite important for the credibility of what you do as a whole if you're trying to embark on a growth strategy. And I would say what our overall challenge between now and February, or in the new year, must be to ensure that we manage this economy in such a way that the good news outweighs the bad news. That's in our hands. It is often said that confidence building is the cheapest form of stimulus. Let's see if we can do that in the next few months by walking the talk more effectively than we've done up until now.
And then lastly, Matthew, on this issue of implementation, government has been positively glacial in its reforms, in implementing things we've been talking about ad nauseum for the last few years. What do you see as primarily the main reason behind our lack of ability to implement inside government?
That's a good question, Michael. I've often asked myself that 10 times a day. Because as Martin is saying, on most issues we agree with each other, 99% of the issues. But there is a frustrating slowness with which government tables issues. They take years and years to table bills that business and labor all agree upon, critical ones to deal with corruption or growing the economy. We have to end up throwing our toys out of the cot as labor to harass government into doing it. Even then, it takes longer and longer. We cannot explain it. I can't explain it. I can point to the issue of the decapacitation of the state over the last decade because of state capture. I can point to the dumbing down of the state, but it's difficult to give explanation to it. Unfortunately, we have to go through the hard work of rebuilding the state. It's going to be painful. What should really take you 1 hour to do something might take you 20 hours of badgering and harassment. Some of the stuff would really belong in a Monty Python skit. I can't explain much, Michael. But I mean, I like what Raymond was saying is about the cheaper form of stimulus is positive confidence building.
And so, absolutely.
You know, it's quite hard to, we like to make demands and complaints, which we must. But we drafted the Eskom Social Compact a year ago and a raft of other economic proposals, because we want to say, what can we do as Labour to help inject that positive confidence building? Just to try to shift the vibe a bit, to tell the nation and the public at large, international investors, we're getting our act together. So it's quite frustrating then, you know, we could have signed up on the Eskom Social Compact in March.
We have to sign off on that note, unfortunately, Matthew. Sure. We've run out of time. On that note, talking about the life of Tito, that was Matthew Parks of Cosatu, joined by economist Raymond Parsons of the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Martin Kingston of Business for South Africa.